So this morning we're starting a new sermon series, and it's titled, When It All Falls Apart. And the truth of the matter is that for all of us, at some point, it will fall apart, right? Life is not going to go the way that we intended it to go, the way that we hoped it would go. And for some of us, when life falls apart, it's going to be more tragic than for others of us. But regardless of the circumstances surrounding what happens when it all falls apart, all of us will experience something in life where it doesn't go according to our plan. Never in a million years would I have imagined that I would be fired from a job. I mean, part of it is just the makeup of who I am as a person, right? I'm a little bit of a perfectionist. I like to do things right, particularly the first time. I don't like to mess up. And I'm really hard on myself. Like, I'm not a perfectionist in the details, but I am a perfectionist in making sure that what I do right. And so I've got that thing going for me. But then there's also this part of me where I'm a people pleaser. I don't like to upset people. I don't like to disappoint people. And it's in my mind, these two things, this perfectionist tendency with this desire to please whoever's around me, my boss, like these two things should make like a model employee. And so putting those together, I never assumed that there would come a day in which I would be fired. And yet it happened. And when it happened, it rocked me. Right? In that moment, it all fell apart. And this understanding of who I am and who I'm called to be, and what I thought I was going to do with my life, all of that, all of a sudden, is up in the air. And when that happens, when everything's up in the air, and when everything else is falling apart, what are you supposed to do? Or Sarah and I having to wrestle with infertility, and now waiting for an adoption to happen. And I never envisioned that this was going to be my life, right? I envisioned getting married. I envisioned having a few years with my bride in which we would enjoy and we would travel and we would do all the things that we would want to do. And then when we were ready, when the time had come, then we would decide that we would have children, right? The time had come, and so we were going to have children, and it was going to happen like within a couple months, like 9 to 12 months after we decided that now was the time, there was going to be a baby in our arms. And when it didn't start happening that way, and when we tried again and it didn't happen, and like that wasn't what we envisioned. I envisioned this time would be full of joy, and it would never be full of disappointment, and never have any frustration, and it would never have some of the anger that we, or particularly I, have experienced. So what do you do when it doesn't go to plan, according to plan? What do you do when it all falls apart? What happens, and what are you supposed, how are you supposed to respond when life takes, or when your plans take a backseat to life? You see, all of us go through something like this. Broken relationships. Loss of loved ones. Terminal diseases. In ourselves or in those whom we love. And these situations never sit well with us. And they shouldn't sit well. I mean, they are examples of what is wrong with the world. I mean, it is in-your-face evidence that the world is broken. But for us as a people of faith, the question reigns. In those moments when life falls apart, when it doesn't go according to plan, when we are face-to-face with the evidence of a broken world, I mean, what do we do with it? I mean, this is really, when we get down to it, this is when us as Christians are wrestling with the questions surrounding suffering and evil in the world. Like, if we believe that God is good, and if we believe that Jesus' death on the cross defeats evil, and if we believe that God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good, then why doesn't he do anything with the evil in the world? Why doesn't he alleviate the very obvious and very painful suffering that happens all around us? Why does he let it continue to exist? And what does it mean for those of us who trust Jesus, who say that Jesus is our Lord and Savior, who believe in the empty tomb and resurrection and truth and beauty and life and that evil has been defeated and Jesus is the great, like, what do we do when we are those people who believe in that and yet our lives fall apart? I mean, does that mean that God is mad at us? Does it mean that in that tragedy, God is trying to teach us a lesson? Like, the only way that I would learn this particular lesson is if God gave me cancer? I mean, is that how God works, particularly how a loving God works? Are those moments when life falls apart, the judgments of God? Is life falling apart because of some sin in my life? Is it because I'm not really saved, or is it because my faith isn't strong enough? I mean, these are questions that all of us, I think if we're being honest with ourselves, I mean, we may not admit it, but if we're being honest with ourselves, if we really let our souls speak in those moments, these are the questions that we all ask. I don't care who you are. I don't care how long you've been a Christian or how many degrees that you have. My systematic theology professor, just an absolutely brilliant guy. He's one of the leading theologians in the country, in the world, really. And at the age of 39, he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, an incurable blood cancer. And this is a disease that 39-year-olds don't typically get. This is one that is usually reserved for those in 60s and 70s. And when people get it in that stage of life, they are told that they have a relatively short time, maybe 5 years at the most. And so for him at 39, they kind of go, well, we don't know, this isn't normal. And this really caused him to wrestle, as it would any of us. And he wrote a wonderful book. It is a book I cannot recommend enough. It's called Rejoicing in Lament. And in the book, he describes this scene of a couple of weeks after having been diagnosed. He goes into his pastor's office. Now, this is a theologian. This is a teacher of systematic theology, one who has won awards, international awards. This is a guy who believes in Reformed theology, the sovereignty of God, all of this. I mean, he has all the answers, right? And yet, a couple of weeks after he's told that he has cancer, he goes into his pastor's office, and he describes this moment where he's just having this crisis of faith. He's beginning to ask the questions that all of us are asking. And the question that he asks is, what if my faith isn't enough? What if Nettie and Nathaniel are going to lose their father because he didn't believe hard enough? All right, these are the questions that anyone who's honest would ask when life falls apart. And so for the next 6 weeks or so, what we are going to do is we're just going to camp out on this question, what do you do when it all falls apart? And we're going to explore it from all these different angles. And my hope is that we will be able to talk about these things with honesty and authenticity. And my hope is that for some of you, because some of you are finding yourself in that place right now, you are in the place where life is falling apart. And my hope is if you are in that place, that you will find this sermon series comforting, encouraging, hopeful. Most of all, that you'll know that you're not alone. And for others of you, my hope is that this would prepare you for when life does fall apart. I mean, right now, life is good. Right now, everything is kind of the way it is, and you would just hope that it stays this way. But the reality is nothing stays the same. Like, that's the inevitable. At some point, it's going to happen. And my hope is that this would at least provide a little bit more of a stable foundation, right? I don't think you can ever get away with a foundation that doesn't get rocked at some level when it all falls apart. Like, it'll still rock and it'll still shake, but maybe you'll still have something to stand on, or at least something to lay down on, right, in that moment. And so my hope is that this would prepare you a little bit so that when it happens, you don't have to wrestle with some of the painful questions of, am I good enough? Is my faith strong enough? I mean, maybe you still wrestle with those, but maybe not to the same degree. And for others of us, life has already fallen apart. And maybe we never dealt with these questions. Maybe we just lifted up the rug and we swept them underneath there. Or we locked them in the closet and are like hoping that they don't come out. But they've been bubbling and festering just beneath the surface. And my hope is that for those of us for whom that's true, that maybe we let them out and we wrestle with them. And maybe we find some healing for something that happened a long time ago that we never got healing on before. And so regardless of where we are in that, I hope that God reveals himself and we see God in some new and some clear ways. And so what I want to do today is I actually want to back up just a little bit. I just want to look at faith. Because really when we talk about what do you do when it all falls apart, or I mean, what we're talking about there is how do you hold a faith, right? In the midst of suffering, in the midst of pain, in the midst of a world that is not as it should be, how do you hold on to your faith? And so what I want to do is I want to back up just a little bit, and I want to talk about what faith is and what faith isn't. And I want to look at a particular passage in Scripture. It's just going to be a real short passage in James. And it's one that... It's one that maybe we don't necessarily turn to when things go bad, but it's a passage that has informed the way many of us think when things go bad. And there's this misreading of this passage that I would say is hurtful and it's harmful, particularly in the midst of everything falling apart. And so I want to look at that. And I'll wrestle with it a little bit, and I want to see where we come out on the end. All right, so let's go to James chapter 1, and we'll start at verse, we'll look at verse 5 and 6, but we'll start at verse 6, and actually we'll read James 6, 7, and 8. James chapter 1, 6, 7, and 8. So let's go. Verse 6. But when they ask, they must believe and not doubt. Because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not think they will receive anything from the Lord. They are a double-minded individual, unstable in all they do. Now, the most common way that we read a passage in the Bible is just to kind of take it at face value. Right? So we just look at the passage and we say, like, this is the very plain reading of the passage. This is what it means. And so if we were to do that with this passage, just take the plain reading right off the surface. Don't try to nuance it. Don't try to dive into it. And just say, okay, what is James saying in these couple of verses? It would simply be this: have no doubts. That's what James is saying. But that if you are going to ask God for something, then you cannot doubt that you are going to get that thing. Because the moment you doubt, the moment you begin to question whether or not God will give you whatever it is that you ask him for, well, now you're like a double-minded individual and you are not going to receive anything from the Lord. So this idea is, if you want God to do something on your behalf, then you have to believe and not doubt. Because if you doubt, God isn't going to give it to you. And this is kind of how it gets, like, this is the plain reading of the passage, and this is gets passed around. This is how it works. This is what faith is like. Now, very quickly, that is an absolutely horrendous reading of this passage. Just horrendous. Namely, because it avoids context. If you look at verse 5, look at verse 5 here. If any of you lacks wisdom, should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to them. Right? So the context of this is wisdom. James is writing about wisdom. If you desire wisdom, God will give you wisdom, and don't doubt the fact that God will and can give you wisdom. But this promise is connected only to wisdom. It isn't about everything else. But this is what happens so often, right? We take a Bible verse and we pluck it out of context and we slap it onto a bookmark, and then it gets twisted into all these unhelpful and even harmful ways. And this verse, twisted out of context, makes doubting wrong. Your faith is no longer faith. Rather, faith gets replaced by certainty. And your faith is only as strong as you are certain. Right? That's the reading. That's the implied reading here. That if you are certain God will do something, then he will. But if you aren't certain, then he won't. Right? Faith in this context, if you're reading this passage, just sort of the plain reading, and you broadly apply it, this passage makes faith completely unnecessary because certainty has replaced faith. And this thinking is pervasive in American Christian evangelical thought, particularly when it comes to prayer. A number of years ago, when I was right out of seminary, still green behind the ears and everything, I started meeting with a woman who was dying of cancer. And she would talk to me about the faith that she had that God would heal her, and that her faith was so strong, she would go to these faith healers here in Indianapolis, and she would travel to Ohio to go with them, and she would tell me that she is going and she is certain that God would heal her, or that God would heal her through these individuals, right? And she was just absolutely certain about it, to the point that she couldn't have a conversation. Because I began just to ask the question, what if it doesn't happen? What if you travel all the way to Ohio and you don't get healed? And she wouldn't go there. She couldn't have that conversation. I mean, she would say things like, well, I just can't doubt. I can't doubt that God will heal me. No, she had to be certain about it. Because if you doubt, then obviously that displays a lack of faith and God won't heal you. You have to have enough faith. But it's not really faith, is it? It's certainty. You have to have enough certainty. This is the thinking. In 2014, Time magazine reported on a mother and a father who were arrested after their second child died when they refused to give that child medical treatment. It happened to two of their kids. One was 2 years old at the time, and the other one was 8 months old when they died. Both children not given medical care because they believed the parents were operating under the assumption that if they had enough faith, God would heal their children, and their children died of pneumonia. In Oregon, there's a church where since 1976, there are roughly 80 child deaths that are connected with this church because of their belief in faith healing. Now, don't hear me saying what I'm not saying. I am not saying you shouldn't believe in healing. I am not saying that prayer doesn't work, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't pray for healing. But I am saying that this is exactly the kind of thinking that comes from the misinterpretation of a passage like this. This thinking that if you just have enough faith, and again, it's not even faith, it's certainty. If you just have enough certainty, then God will heal you, right? And if you don't have enough faith, if you don't have enough certainty, then God won't. And so if you go to the doctor to get medicine, then you don't really trust God, and because you don't trust him, he won't heal you. And if you really trusted God, if you really believed, if you really had faith, if you were really certain, then you wouldn't go to the doctor. But since you go to the doctor, it's obvious you don't. And the line of thinking also blames you if you continue to get sick or if someone dies, right? If you don't get healed, then obviously you didn't have enough faith. I mean, do you see how vicious this is? You're left constantly trying to prove yourself good enough, that you have enough faith, that you're certain enough. And if everything falls apart, you're left assuming that you aren't good enough. Now, we don't have a lot of people here not taking their kids to the doctor. Praise Jesus. But there are a number of us wrestling with the question, am I good enough? Do I have enough faith? And we especially wrestle with that question when everything falls apart. When life hits the fan, am I good enough? Did I do something wrong? Is God mad at me? And let me just say this, and hopefully this you find this comforting. It is the most natural thing in the world to ask questions when it all falls apart. It is the most natural thing to ask questions when it all falls apart. To ask the questions, why? What is this about? Where are you, God? Are you who you say that you are? But the moment those doubts creep in, for so many of us, that's when shame also creeps in, because suddenly we feel like we're failing as Christians because we've been taught somewhere along the line, maybe even implicitly, we've been taught that doubting is bad. Doubting is a sign that you don't have enough faith. Doubting means that God will get mad at you or be disappointed at you or will not give you what you need in that moment. Doubting means that you are a failure. And so what you have to do is you have to pretend that you don't have any doubt. You've got to act as if you are 100% certain that God is going to heal you or provide for you or do whatever, right? And so you have to act as if those things that you're asking for have already healed. Are you praying for more money? Are you praying that God would rescue from a financial situation? Well, spend money like you already have it. Have the faith and act as if it's already true and you already have all that money. Are you praying for healing? Then act like you're already healed. Are you praying that you can fly? Then jump off the roof. I realize that maybe I'm a little bit snarky here. But the reason I am is because I believe that this kind of teaching is so unbelievably harmful and hurtful, and it is not what we learn from Jesus. The whole interpretation of this passage, this whole approach to faith, makes faith completely irrelevant because all you need is certainty. And in the end, certainty becomes the thing that saves you. And if certainty is the thing that saves you, then it's become an idol. Certainty is the thing that we trust more than Jesus, because it's certainty that will get us what it is that we want, right? We want to be healed. We want God to step in and do something. We want to be saved. But God will only do those things. God will only give what we ask. And if we're asking to be saved, God will only do those things if we are certain enough. Right? Certainty becomes our idol. And if certainty is our idol, then we have to protect it. You see, you always have to protect your idol. Anything that threatens your idol will be perceived as evil. And so anything that threatens certainty, like doubt, is evil. And anything then that causes doubt, anything that challenges a belief that you're holding on to, that becomes dangerous or evil. And so science gets demonized by Christians because it raises questions that forces us to wrestle with our faith. And it forces us to wrestle with the text and what's happening in what we read and what we are learning about the world around us. And college is feared because our young adults get exposed to new thinking and new worldviews. And they're things that challenge the world that we've inherited from our parents or maybe even from our churches. And maybe we even begin to doubt those worldviews and those long-held beliefs. And anything that causes us to doubt is evil. Because it's evil to doubt. It's sinful to doubt. Because it challenges our idol, which is certainty. And we believe that doubt will land us in time out with God and bad things will happen to us. And so anything that makes us doubt, or anyone who causes us to doubt, is evil. And it's not just out there, it also turns inward, right? If doubt is evil, if doubt is wrong and I doubt, then I must be bad. I am sinful or wrong. And I've seen this so many times as a pastor. People wondering if they're saved or wondering if God is just mad at them because they have doubts. And listen, this is only true. God is only mad at you if you have doubts, or he's only mad at you if you've got some questions, if certainty is what saves us. But certainty doesn't save us. Jesus saves us. And I know that sounds elementary, but the fact that Jesus saves us changes everything. With Jesus, faith is no longer about certainty. It's about relationship. And in relationship, I trust what I know of the person. You see, in a relationship, we're never certain, not 100%, not about everything. I mean, we may be certain about the person, but we may not be certain about everything that's going to happen in the midst of that relationship. I mean, just think about when you get married, and you're standing there, and you're standing across from the person, and you're holding each other's eyes, and you're looking into each other's tear-filled eyes, right? And in that moment, you promise, for better or for worse. You make that promise because you trust what you know in the person. You have no idea in that moment what worse means. You have no clue what is in the future. And if you did, I don't know that you'd have any ability to make that commitment to that person in that moment. But what you do is you stand there and you hold their hands and you look them in the eyes. And you say, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. You make that commitment because you know. And you're confident of what you know about the person. And so whatever happens in the future, whatever we may face in the future, I am committed to you. I trust you. And we will get through this. I mean, when Sarah and I stood there and we held each other's hands and we looked in each other's eyes and we said, for better, for worse, we had no clue what that meant, right? Sarah had no idea that when she said, for better, for worse, that that included me getting fired. Sarah didn't know that when she said, for better, for worse, that it included the certainty that comes with job loss and dealing with an insecure husband and selling our house and moving back into student housing. She had no idea that meant moving to Indiana. And yet she knew enough in that moment to say, I do. I'm in. I believe we can overcome anything. And it's kind of like that with God. When we commit to Jesus, we have no idea what we will have to go through. We don't know what life entails. And we cannot guarantee that things will not fall apart. And following Jesus doesn't save us from that. And we can still guarantee for each other that more than likely life will fall apart. But when we follow Jesus, what we're doing is we're making that commitment. No matter what comes our way, I'm in. And faith is saying, what I know of you causes me to trust you. What I know of you, Jesus, is that you will get me through no matter what. Faith is trusting in the midst of uncertainty. Faith is saying, God, I don't know where you are and I don't know what you are doing, but I trust you. And I'm waiting for you to show up. See, faith isn't the lack of certainty or the absence of certainty. Faith isn't the absence of uncertainty. Faith is staying in the relationship despite your uncertainty. I mean, think about it like this. Maybe this is clear. Courage isn't the absence of fear, but it's a willingness to act in spite of your fear. Faith isn't the absence of doubt. It's the willingness to stay committed and stay in the relationship with your doubts. And faith is a commitment, or to use the theological relational term, faith is a covenant. It's this, I've got questions, but you and I are going to work them out and I'm not leaving. Jeremiah 17, there's this image, right? And Jeremiah is speaking on behalf of God. And he says this, he says, cursed is the man who trusts in humankind and makes his flesh his strength, for he will be like a bush in the desert. Now, what happens to the bush in the desert? It dries up and it dies, right? And Jeremiah is saying that the one who trusts in his flesh, in the strength of his flesh, he is like the bush in the desert. They will shrivel up and they will die. And I think this is sometimes what we do with faith. Rather than acknowledging that we have doubt and letting faith be faith, right? We've replaced faith with certainty, but then all of a sudden life falls apart or whatever reason, all these questions start to come up and now we don't have certainty, now we've got doubts. But because it's wrong to doubt and because we believe in a certain kind of certainty, not in a faith that still has uncertainty or stays committed in spite of its doubts, right? Now we've got to have certainty, but we don't want to acknowledge those certainties, so we try to lock them away in the closet or sweep them up under the rug, and we try by the strength of our flesh to pretend that those doubts aren't there. We try to force ourselves by our sheer will to believe, and our flesh becomes our strength. And our ability to make ourselves certain determines whether or not we believe that we are a good Christian. And that's exhausting. Do that long enough and you'll dry up. You'll be like a bush in the desert. And Jeremiah says, he says, but the one who trusts in the Lord will be like one planted next to a stream. They will not dry up when the heat comes, when it all falls apart, when the questions and the doubts come, when we've got faith enough to doubt, then we can take all those doubts and all those questions and we can take them and just hang on to them in the space between us and God and say, okay, I'm in, God, I'm committed, and I've got these questions and we've got to work through them. And I'm expecting you to work in a way that only you can, and I don't know how you're going to, and I don't know what you're going to, and I don't even know that I'm not okay with everything that just happened, but I'm trusting you. I'm in. When you have faith enough to doubt, it's like a bush next to a stream. It's still hot. It's uncomfortable. The heat can be nearly unbearable. But you won't die. And so when it all falls apart and the questions come, the key isn't to push the questions aside and pretend that they aren't there. It's to acknowledge them. It's to trust Jesus enough to know that you can ask questions and he isn't going to walk away. It's to remember that Jesus drew near to the one who said, I do believe, but help my unbelief. I mean, isn't that most of us? Aren't most of us on the one hand going, I do believe, but on the other hand, I don't know that I believe. Like, I've got all these questions and all these places where I have unbelief. I mean, isn't this most of us? Yeah. And Jesus didn't condemn that man. I mean, Jesus didn't say, oh, well, you have some doubts, and then he walked away. Jesus didn't scold Thomas for saying, not unless I see the holes in his hands and touch his side. Not unless any of that do I believe. No, Jesus held his hands out. And he let Thomas touch him. In other words, Jesus gave Thomas exactly what he needed. And I believe if you and I are honest about our doubts, then he will give us exactly what we need as well. Let's pray.